This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 69 of What's It Like. My guest is Ken Ramirez, somewhere in the Midwest, right?
That's right. I'm in Chicago, as a matter of fact.
Oh, Chicago in the winter. How nice.
Yes.
Did you grow up in that area?
No, I did not. I actually moved to Chicago to help build and design an animal habitat for the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. So I came here. It's been about 23 years now, but I moved here for the purposes of designing a marine mammal habitat and pavilion for the aquarium here.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Where did you grow up?
I grew up actually in West Texas and in southern New Mexico. I grew up on a cattle ranch there that my family still runs and operates.
Hmm. Did you come from a large family?
My immediate family was not large. My immediate family was just my mom, dad, sister, and myself. But certainly, when I look out at my aunts and uncles and so forth, it's a fairly large family, yes.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, what was your major challenge as a child?
I don't know. It's interesting. I think my biggest challenge as a child was that my parents were always on the move. But in the early years, my father was in the Army, and then after that, both he and my mother pursued their master's degrees and their PhDs at different universities. And so I was constantly on the move and never in the same place for very long. My only constant was coming back to my family's ranch every year, but I would go to school at different schools. And so I think probably the most formative thing for me growing up was the fact that I constantly had to get into new schools and meet new friends, and that got tiresome after a while. I went to so many different schools that it was a challenge for me.
So when you graduated from high school, what did you do?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I ended up going to, first I went to community college and studied at San Antonio College, and then from there I went on to NYU in New York University in Greenwich Village, and then I jumped from there to the other coast and went to UCLA, and then from there I moved back to Texas and went to the University of Houston, and so I bounced around to a lot of different colleges, and now I wasn't following my parents anymore. It was just sort of in my blood, I guess, but I went for a variety of different reasons having to do with jobs and other things like that, but ended up finishing up with a double major, both in biology and in psychology, with a focus on animal behavior.
So you did follow your parents' example, and now you combine both education and animals.
Absolutely.
Did you always want to work with animals?
No, it's interesting. Although I've always loved animals since I can remember, from a very young age, I grew up around them, and I think I just took having animals around my life for granted and just assume that to be just a part of life all the time. And then as I got older and was no longer around them all the time, I really found that I missed them. And so I began doing some volunteer work with a number of organizations, still not really thinking that was necessarily going to be a career for me. But toward the end of high school, and because of some of the volunteer work I was doing, it really motivated me to look at working in an animal-related field. But my focus at the time was in dog training and in working with guide dogs for the visually impaired, because that was where I volunteered, was for one of those organizations. And so it was being involved in guide dog work that really excited me, because it was, as I watched the training going on, at the time, as I was still in high school then, I couldn't think of a job that could be more fun than playing with dogs all day long, but in the end, training them for a very good cause. And so to me, it was like the best of all possible worlds, working with animals, training them for a good cause, but having fun in the whole process of doing it, but ultimately knowing you were making a difference in somebody's life by doing that kind of training. And so when I went to college, in my head, becoming a guide dog trainer was one of the things that I thought I might be destined to do. And that's sort of what prompted me to study animal behavior and psychology.
How did you learn to train dogs?
Well, I didn't necessarily learn to train dogs specifically. What I did was I volunteered at the Institute for the Blind for 3 years and certainly was exposed to it. But then I went to college and studied animal behavior and studied psychology. And of course, studying all of those topics in school does not teach you to be a trainer. It just teaches you a lot of theory and a lot of information. However, the things that I had seen and the things that I had witnessed in my 3 years of working around dogs suddenly all made sense from a theoretical perspective from all the studies that I had in college. Then, as I was finishing up college, and actually I had about a semester of school left, but there was an opening for an education specialist at a marine life park in Texas, and they were looking for someone to help teach some classes and narrate some of their dolphin and killer whale shows and sea lion shows. And it sounded like a fun summer job because it was outdoors and on the beach and it was around animals, but I'd never necessarily had a fascination or interest in exotic animals or marine mammals. But I took that particular job, and as I worked around the organization and worked around many of the professional trainers there, all of a sudden I was beginning to see that the same techniques that had been used to train guide dogs were also being employed to train dolphins and whales and birds. And I also realized that all of the things that I had been studying in school as it related to animal behavior was directly related to exactly what they were doing in the training that they were doing at the park that I was at. I began to volunteer my time outside of my everyday job of narrating and teaching classes with the animal staff, and they had a rehabilitation program for stranded animals there, and so I spent a lot of time off, giving my time to on my days off to working in that area, and I think a lot of the trainers and a lot of the curators saw that I had this real good background of knowledge that I had gained from working with dogs and from studying animal behavior in school. And at the end of the summer, they had an opening for an entry-level position, and they offered it to me. And it was one of those things I wasn't pursuing, I wasn't actually thinking of doing, but when they offered me the opportunity, I thought, well, I can't pass this up. This is a really cool opportunity to learn to work with dolphins and whales and work with some really good trainers who I could be under their wing and learn from them. And I thought, well, I'll do that for 2 or 3 years, and then I'll pursue dog training. Then I will go back to guide dogs and so forth. But that was 36 years ago, I guess, now that I entered into the exotic animal world, and I have been working in that world ever since. And during the time that I have worked in the zoo profession, I have had the good fortune of working with a wide variety of species, marine mammals, exotic birds, big cats, primates. And so I really began to see and find that the training skills that I had learned were really applicable across the board. As I often tell, I now teach a graduate course on animal training at Western Illinois University, and I often tell my students that the techniques for training are the same whether you're training an earthworm or a Harvard graduate. We all learn the same way, and if you understand the laws of learning, you can teach anything much, much faster simply by understanding what those laws of learning are. But my realization of how training all came to be was really sort of an unusual path, because it wasn't a perfectly well planned out path where I thought, here's where I'm going to go and here's the way to get there. I went down paths but ended up taking detours along the way. And interestingly enough, 35 years later or 40 years later, I come full circle. And in the last 15 years, not only do I continue to do a lot of work with exotic animals in the zoo and aquarium field, but about 15 years ago, I re-entered the dog training world as a consultant and on the side, and in the last 3 or 4 years have started working with guide dog organizations. And so it was where I was thinking I would be many, many, many years ago, and just in the last 2 or 3 years, I'm back and I'm actually doing that, but doing it from a far different perspective as a consultant coming in and bringing some of the positive reinforcement knowledge that I've learned from working with such a wide variety of species and helping organizations to transition from more traditional dog training methods to the more positive reinforcement techniques, which can really be something that benefits the animals in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been at the shed for quite a long time.
Yes, I came here to help put this program together at the end of 88, early 1989. So, yeah, I'm coming upon my 23rd year here at the Shedd Aquarium here in another month or so.
So what exactly do you do?
Well, I am the, my title is the, I am the Executive Vice President of Animal Care and Training for Shedd Aquarium. What that really means is that I'm responsible for overseeing all of the animal care divisions. We have 32,000 animals here at Shedd, representing nearly 1,500 species. And so I have a very large staff, and I oversee the long-term planning, budget, staffing, animal care decision-making and planning for all of the collection. Now, my area of expertise is animal behavior, so I get props perhaps a little bit more into the weeds and into the more of the day-to-day aspect of the care when it comes to the training aspect. But ultimately, I'm responsible for the entire collection and for the staff that, that cares for the animals here.
What's the best thing about your job?
I think there's two things that I find that I love about my job. The first is the obvious one. I love interacting with animals on a day-to-day basis. I love building a relationship, teaching an animal, and helping to provide better care and better life for that animal. So to me, that interaction with the animal, which is often the reason many of us are gravitate toward animal care, is absolutely one of the best parts of the job. But for me, the second best aspect of the job is being able to share what I do and share the knowledge I've gained with others, whether it be visitors coming to the aquarium or whether it be students taking one of my classes. I love being able to give back to people information that they can use that'll help them understand the animal world better, practice better conservation when it comes to animal care, or make them a better trainer. I love that interaction with people as it relates to the animals. So those are probably the two best parts of my job.
Well, let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
I think the worst thing about the job, there's just probably, I gave you two things that were good. I'm going to give you three things that are bad. I think the challenges to this job are many. And it's often when I'm talking to young people about wanting to get into the field, I like them to have wide open eyes about what the challenges are in the field. The first is financial. This is not the kind of job you take because you're going to get rich doing it. You take this kind of work because you like it, because you're passionate about it. When you go and look at every one of my peers who may have graduated from college at the same time as I did, whether they're a plumber or a teacher, a lawyer, a doctor, or a hairdresser, every single one of them probably makes a higher wage than I do. But I'm okay with that because I would venture that few of them enjoy their job as much as I do. But you do have to recognize when going into this field that you have to stick with it a long time. And certainly by the time you get to a level like mine, I can actually earn a living and pay a mortgage and support a family. But it took me a long time to get to that level. And so it's not the kind of job that pays exceedingly well. The second down part of the job is it is physically demanding. It is there's long hours, heavy lifting, cold water diving, unusual working conditions, and usually for someone right out of college, it's a piece of cake. It's a very active kind of job. But as you get older and your body is incapable of doing the things it could do as a teenager or as a person in their 20s or 30s, you begin to find that you find limitations in what you're capable of doing because the job can be so physically demanding. And third, it can have an extremely take a really tough toll on your social life. Because if you're truly, the thing about working with animals is it's not a 9-to-5 job. You cannot look at your watch and go, ooh, like that's like being a parent. You can't look at your watch and say, sorry, kids, 5 o'clock, I'm off duty now. Problems are your own. When you take an animal care position, you are signing on to be responsible for the well-being and the care of an animal who might need care at 3 o'clock in the morning or who might need care on 4th of July, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. So oftentimes when you can't be there for a holiday function, when you're not available for a family reunion because you're trying to take care of the animal's needs, it can take a toll on your social life. And when someone's young and just out of college, they're usually able to say, hey, I can handle this. I can do all of this. It doesn't matter to me. But then as you enter into more serious relationships, to get married, have a family, those things can be very, very difficult for some people, and it can take a real toll on that social life.
Sometimes you have to choose between the tigers and the kids?
Well, it's not a choice, because you're responsible as a parent, you're responsible for your children, but as an animal care professional, you're also responsible for those tigers. So consequently, you can't let either one of them suffer. So it's not that you choose one over the other, but assuming that the kids are all doing well in school, and the kids are all healthy, and the tigers are sick, and the tigers are needing help, you sometimes have to go, and those things don't necessarily happen on a vacation schedule or a holiday schedule or a weekend schedule. And so it puts pressures on you that can be very, very difficult for families to understand.
Mm-hmm. If someone wanted to have a job like yours, how would they go about getting it?
What I would tell most people is a couple of things. One, I would encourage people to study in school and pursue a degree in a related field. And a related field can be quite vast, but it can be biology, marine biology, zoology, animal behavior, environmental science. The list of relevant fields or related fields is endless. But I encourage people to find a major that they're passionate about that has some connection to the animal care world. However, just having the degree is not going to be enough to get you a job. In fact, you can have a master's and a PhD, and that just means you have the book knowledge. It doesn't mean you have the actual patience to work with the living animal. So the second requirement besides the degree and the knowledge is practical experience. And you gain practical experience through volunteer positions, internship positions. Otherwise, it's a catch-22. Nobody will hire you if you don't have experience, but you can't get experience if nobody will hire you. But you can get volunteer experiences, and that is where the vast majority of us who work in this field, you know, I work with exotic animals every day, but I started volunteering at a guide dog organization. You can volunteer at your local animal shelter, volunteer at a rehab center. You can volunteer at a veterinary clinic. You can volunteer at a zoo or an aquarium. All of those experiences start to give you the opportunity to learn about working in this field. So those are the first two things that I often encourage people to do, is pursue the degree, you do well in school, but also look for opportunities to gain that practical experience. The next thing I would often recommend to people is don't put blinders on. Too often, people get fascinated by a specific kind of job. They go, I want to work with gorillas in the zoo, or I want to work with dolphins in the aquarium, or I want to work with search and rescue dogs. And oftentimes, the reality is that those are difficult professions to get into starting there. And if you put blinders on and simply say, nope, I'm not interested in any kind of animal care work unless it's with gorillas or unless it's with dolphins, what happens is you lose out the opportunity to gain experiences cleaning up dog kennels. And cleaning dog kennels at a shelter or at any other facility is a way to get your foot in the door at working with animals. And too often I see young people literally not want to look at those, what they think of as peripheral jobs, or, no, I don't want to work with dogs, I want to work with gorillas or dolphins. And so they won't take a job working at a horse stable or at a dog kennel where they can gain such valuable husbandry experience and animal care experience that will look good on their resume and get them in the door to the kind of job they eventually want.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Well, there is no such thing as a typical day, and it's probably one of the things that I love about my job, is that there is no routine. There is no normal. My day at some days of the week may start as early as 4 or 5 in the morning, while other times I may not have to start my day till 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Some days I may get out early, and other days I may be working till 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. So often it's very much revolves around what the animal's needs are. But in a typical day, let's assume we have no animals that are sick, no animals that are pregnant, no research projects, no special media opportunities. It's just a typical day. Well, throughout the day, I may have an opportunity to do an animal feed or a training session with a variety of different animals every hour or so. After that, I have to do records and write my records up and enter them into the computer, clean up some buckets and so forth. Usually have a few meetings to attend in the day. As in my particular position as a administrator as well, much of my day is spent in meetings, but I'm a hands-on administrator and I do work with the animals still on a pretty regular basis. So the typical animal care person on our staff is basically their entire day is food preparation, feeding an animal, doing a record, food preparation, training session, record keeping, and the food preparation, another training session and record keeping. And that goes on all day with a heavier amount of food preparation in the morning and then a heavier amount of cleaning at the end of the day, but feeding sessions and training sessions throughout the day. As you gain responsibility within an organization like this, you still do all of those things, but you may do it a little bit less and have to add to that training meetings with staff, business or planning meetings and things of that kind to organize your department or your facility. But what's also cool about our job is there's tons of things that are unexpected. You have an animal that's ill that needs special care. You have a research project that you're involved with that requires you to do some special training. You have a media opportunity to where you're meeting, having a film crew come in and do some special filming, or you're doing a VIP tour for someone who may be a potential donor or a celebrity guest that's coming through, or you have there's any number of things that happen on a day-to-day basis that make our day very, very interesting. And even if all you did was training session after training session after training session, or feeding session after feeding session, you have different types of animals you're working with, and each time you interact with them, it's different, it's fun, you're building relationships with them. So the day is full of nonstop activity, and then there's also parts of our job that require us to dive so that we can clean habitats, or that require us to go into an enclosure and build special enrichment devices and enrichment games for animals to play with. So there's all sorts of aspects to the job that make it interesting and different every day.
So Ken, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
You know, that's not hard for me. You know, all I have to do is remind myself that my job is about providing a better life for the animals that I work with. All I've got to do is look into the face of an animal that I work with and go, this is why I'm doing this. This is why I'm here. And so even when the day is difficult or when you're not feeling your best, taking a look at the animals and seeing that relationship you have always is a pick-me-up. And it's one of the reasons why it's not hard to get boosted up when working in this kind of a job, because there is that that aspect to it that makes it so rewarding.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to calm yourself down, how do you soothe yourself?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know that I guess when I need to take a break from everything, you know, it's sometimes it's just, again, not interacting with an animal, perhaps going out and just watching an animal sleep, watching an animal interact with its with other members of its group without them knowing you're there, and you just have that serene moment of watching that peaceful interaction, and it's a great way to sort of come down off of the high of whatever it is that you've been doing, but still brings you down to, hey, this is what this is all about. This is really cool.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
You know, there's a lot of events, I suppose, that have challenged me over the years, and whether it be particular challenges with employees or with a particularly stubborn or difficult animal, or dealing with government bureaucracy and legislation, I think those are always aspects to what we do every day. I think when you work with animals throughout your career and throughout your life, that natural circle of life comes around at some point, and an animal that you know very well, that you've built a great relationship with, comes to the end of their life, and they're older, and there comes that point when they end up dying, and oftentimes that can be a real challenging and trying time, very much like losing a very close member of your family. Those are always difficult times. Those are always challenging times to cope with. And then when you're in a position of responsibility like I am, you also not only are having to deal with that heartbreak yourself, but you also are trying to find a way to help deal with it for the staff that you're responsible for, and helping to comfort them when you yourself would like to be comforted, can be a challenging time. And so those are the serious ones. And then I think the other one is that comes up with some regularity is as a strong proponent for positive reinforcement methods of training. There are still many traditional trainers in this world, trainers that still use punishments, that use corrections and so forth. And in wanting to help convert people to this more humane and positive reinforcement way of training, there are often roadblocks put up there by the more traditional trainers who have thousands of years of history on their side. And consequently, those create a professional challenges that I think have become easier to overcome in recent years, but still present unique hurdles that I have to face on a pretty regular basis.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through your challenges?
Well, I think being a positive reinforcement trainer means I truly try to look at the world in a very optimistic and positive way. I'm a realist, and I realize that there's those challenges out there, but because I know that what the work that we do is important and it helps animals and people in the long run, then it's easy to get motivated and it's easy to pull yourself out of those challenging situations because you recognize, hey, this is for a good cause and this is helpful and the right thing to do for these animals. So don't let yourself get down for too long. Get back out there and keep fighting the fight and try to help make things better. And so I tend not to be one that dwells on the negatives because I don't think that's very productive. I'll realistically look at a situation, understand what the challenges are, but then look at the benefits that are going to come about if I continue doing this project or continue working toward these goals. And that's the thing that gives me that kick in the pants, or that motivates me, as it were, to keep going.
For those unfamiliar with positive reinforcement, how would you summarize it?
Well, positive reinforcement, basically, everything we do in life, all creatures, are motivated by what you get or don't get from a situation. If you think about choices that you make, do you want to go to that movie, yes or no? Well, you either like that type of movie or hate that type of movie. When you hate a movie because it's boring, that's punishing, and you don't want to go. When you like the movie because it's funny or it's action-filled, you want to go. On the other hand, then when you make choices about do you want to go to the bar with somebody, well, if you like that person a lot and they're a lot of fun to be with, then that's reinforcing and that's motivating. But if the person that you go to the bar with is somebody you don't like or who's boring or who insults you all the time or is just no fun, then that's punishing and it causes you to not want to go out with them very often. So every decision we make in life, every animal's decision that they make in life is based on what's reinforcing or what's punishing. We tend to want to avoid what's punishing, and we want to do what's reinforcing. In the traditional animal training world, there was the belief that to be a successful trainer, you needed to dominate the animal, and thus you needed to be able to punish them when they did something wrong, reinforce them when they do something right. And there was a real tendency for traditional trainers to put a large percentage of their focus on punishing unwanted behavior. A positive reinforcement trainer doesn't look at it that way. Instead of punishing wrong behavior, our focus is on, well, what is it we want the animal to do instead? And let's see if we can reinforce desired behavior. And it kind of, the whole idea is to give the animal an outlook on what it's going to do by motivating it through positive reinforcement, through whether it's food or games or toys or relationships, that animals work hard because it's fun, not because they were forced to. And in traditional training, a lot of traditional training was about forcing animals to comply with our will. Positive reinforcement training is about encouraging them to participate because they want to, because it's fun. And what you find in that situation is you find an animal who's happier, who's more motivated, and isn't afraid and doesn't have stress. And the example I would give is you look across the workplace. Look at the people who go to work every day and do a good job because they love their job, they're proud of their job, they appreciate the paycheck they get. Or look at those people that go to work and do a good job, but the only reason they do a good job is because they're afraid of getting fired or they're afraid of getting into trouble. Who's having a better time? Both work. I can manage a staff member with fear and threaten to fire them if they don't do better, or I can manage them through promoting them, through giving them new tasks when they do well, telling them they did a good job, thanking them for a job well done. The ones that you're using that positive reinforcement with are happier, more motivated individuals. The ones that you're using the coercion and the force and the punishment do well, but they get ulcers, they're not enjoying their job, they're looking for new jobs, looking to quit. It's the same thing in the animal world. You can train using one or the other. You can use both. I tend to believe that you can accomplish so much more if your primary focus is on the use of positive reinforcement. It is the most humane way to train, and from it you get highly motivated animals that are performing well because they like it, because they want to, as opposed to because they have to.
It's the power of thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's as I said, and when we first started this, when it comes to training, you can train an earthworm or a Harvard graduate the same. It's just that saying thank you to an earthworm is not a very reinforcing thing. With an earthworm, it requires light or warmth, etc., darkness and cold, to be able to motivate their behavior. But with people, you can motivate them with kindness, with thank yous, with all sorts of different types of reinforcers. What you find in the animal training world is there's actually quite a big array of reinforcers that you can use there as well. Food is what a lot of people think of, but as you build a relationship with animals, games, toys, and the relationship itself can be a very motivating thing for an animal. As we work in the guide dog world, for example, to come full circle with where I started, in the traditional way of training guide dogs were trained using a lot of compulsion, a lot of you must do it this way, and the animals did it because they thought they would get in trouble if they didn't. As dog training organizations are moving more and more to positive reinforcement training, you're finding that the working life of that dog is far extended. They can work for many years more because there's not the stress level involved in it. And they're more accurate and do a better job because they really enjoy the work.
If you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
I think it's an interesting question because one of the things I guess I tend to find often with the students coming up through the school system is I believe that guidance counselors, parents, and teachers sometimes will discourage children from pursuing their dream job, often encouraging them to move toward those jobs that have better pay, that have better security. And while I think that kind of advice is good advice, I don't think that I would want to step on the dreams of a young person if their dream is to work with animals, or their dream is to become a singer or an actor, or their dream is to become whatever it is they want to be. Just because it doesn't seem to be in the mainstream of the typical kind of jobs that are out there, I would encourage young people to look at the options that are there and yes, think about their future, think about what's important to them. And if bottom line, what's important to them are the creature comforts and having the money to do to buy the big house and drive the fancy car, then look for a job that pays well and that's going to be financially secure. Then follow that advice. But if what makes you happy is a more creative endeavor or a more unique kind of job pursuit, like animal care and animal training, don't necessarily close the door if that's your dream. Because I believe that one of the things that is that we all need in our life is something in our lives that really motivates us, that makes us happy. And when we think about the number of hours we all spend in our workplace, do you really want to be working in a job that is not fulfilling, that is not really fulfilling, unless you've really got it all worked out where the only thing that matters to you is having the financial resources to do things in your private life, in your own time, that are important to you, then follow the gold and go for the job that gives you the pay that you want. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, I just know too many people who follow that job that has the security or that has the paycheck that is supposed to be good, and they find themselves miserable in their lives because they are not fulfilling their life with things that make them happy. And I think, you know, our time is too precious, and we have our private time with our family, which is valuable, and we have our work life, which tends to take up a huge part of our life. And I think we have to make sure that both parts are good. And I think I think you can't ignore your personal life, your hobbies, your passion, your family. But how cool is it if your job is also your passion? If you're actually getting to work in and do something that you truly love, and then I tend to find it makes my life so much more complete and so much more rewarding. And so I never really thought about it in terms of giving a speech, a commencement speech, but I do think that I do work with students a lot who are coming out of college and who are looking for careers, and often they've been discouraged from pursuing their dream job because it was not very conventional or the number of jobs weren't there. I definitely think when you look for these unique jobs, you should be realistic about how many of them there are and what the pay is and what the challenges are. But I wouldn't give up on them just because several people tell you that it's a dead-end direction, because it may not be. And I would really encourage people to explore it more and find out what's important to them.
Ken, I would be remiss if I didn't, you've worked with so many different kinds of animals, if I didn't ask you something about, do you have a favorite animal?
You know, I don't necessarily. I think from my perspective, it's kind of like asking a parent, which is your favorite kid? Maybe you might have a favorite child, but you'd be really stupid to ever say so publicly. And the reality is, I find every animal I work with to be fun and to be challenging. And certainly, I kind of find, just like you have in your life, you may have a group of friends, and there's one friend that you love going out and hanging out at the bar with, and another friend that you like to play basketball with, and another friend who's good on, you want to go on vacations with, another friend that you pour your heart out to. You kind of find that when you're working with animals, that different animals fulfill different roles. You know, some just love to play. Others don't love to play, but love to learn. Mm. Others are very active animals and love to do active things with you. And I think that you find that if you can find that niche, that thing that animal enjoys, not only do they want to learn from you, but then you can have a lot of fun with those animals. And I find that different animals give me joy for different reasons. And so there's a lot of different animals that I really enjoy working with. So I'd be hard-pressed to pick one. It'd be hard-pressed to pick even three or four.
There's a theory that says that the ratio of brain size to body size is a good predictor of animal intelligence. Have you found that to be true?
Well, now you're going into a very interesting topic, and one that is very fascinating to me, and I've taught a lot of classes about animal intelligence. And I think brain size is just one factor that might get rolled into intelligence. The reality is, the challenge with talking about intelligence is this. As educators and scientists, we cannot seem to agree on how to gauge human intelligence. if we cannot even agree that an IQ test, for example, is the appropriate way to measure human intelligence, how in the world do we begin to measure the intelligence of animals that live in a world very different from ours? Do I think animals possess an intellect? Absolutely. What is difficult to do is to gauge it. So often people will want to know, well, would you say that that particular animal is as smart as a dog or as smart as a chimp or as smart as a horse or as smart as a 3-year-old, a 10-year-old, a collie? And it's very difficult to do because we don't really have an effective measure of intelligence. However, now after giving you that scientific answer, I will say that as someone who trains lots of animals, there certainly are a variety of species of animals who, once you've trained them something, retain that information for a long time, seem to enjoy training, seem to be able to learn new tasks very, very quickly. Their memories are good. And if, in your opinion, that is a sign of intelligence, then absolutely, I would say that some of the larger-brained animals certainly show perhaps a greater measure of intelligence than others, but it's still a very difficult thing to measure. And in many cases, there are some animals with very large brains that do not seem to be particularly intelligent, and it may be more to do that their brain is used for other functions. And so I think it's an area of study that is endlessly fascinating and one in which there's a great debate about. But I definitely think it's a fun topic to talk about, but a hard one to really quantify and give a definitive answer to.
People they're often surprised when they think or understand that other species may even have a sense of humor, that, you know, an elephant may kid with you. Have you been surprised by anything that you've encountered in your animal world?
I guess in many ways, yes and no, in that you would think that the more I'm involved in working with animals of very, very many different species, that I would cease to be surprised by what they're capable of doing. But I'm not. I'm endlessly fascinated and surprised by many, many different things. And I think it's interesting because when you bring up the subject of intelligence and you look at the study of intelligence, people have for years tried to define intelligence in lots of different ways: brain size, tool use, architecture, communication, language, the ability to deceive, the ability to have morals, the ability to have caregiving behavior. The list of cooperative behavior, all of these things are different things that at one point or another people have said are uniquely human traits or are uniquely intelligent traits. But as you look across the animal kingdom and you study it in depth, you cannot help but be amazed at what animals are capable of, whether it be the amazing engineering and architectural abilities of a termite, the deceptive abilities of certain species of snakes, the communication abilities of a honeybee, the play behavior of crows, the list of unique things that you find in the animal world is pretty remarkable. And just when you think you'd heard it all, you'll see a new discovery, you learn about a new thing that shows that there's a lot of capabilities and a lot of things that animals do out there that are endlessly fascinating, and I think we've just begun to scratch the surface of what animals are capable of and why they're capable of such a variety of things, how they use them in the wild. Are those instinctive behaviors or are they learned behaviors? I think it's one of the things that I love about working in an animal care field and in a biological field, because I think about the things that I learned as facts, quote-unquote facts, when I went to college 35, 40 years ago, and today half the facts I learned are no longer true. In other words, they were not really facts. They were what we believed to be true about the animal kingdom at that time, but they're things that we just didn't know because so much of the animal kingdom is still undiscovered. So much is still yet to be learned. And so what's great about working in this profession is that you're working in a field where you're always on the cutting edge of learning new things and discovering new things, and that makes this job just endlessly fascinating. I love what I do, and I think what I do is important because it helps me to connect our guests at the aquarium to the living world. And part of what we want to do is inspire people to make a difference in the lives of the animals around us.
I want to thank Ken Ramirez for joining me today. Thanks, Ken. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.